You're listening to The Sound of Economics. I'm Nicholas Barrett.
I am Maria de Merzies.
I'm Nicolas Potier.
And today we're talking about the EU-UK trade deal after Brexit, and whether it can happen in 1 year. And I want to say, before we get started, a special hello to those of you who only listen when we talk about Brexit. There's about 300 or 400 of you, and if you know anything about the economics of scarcity, you'll know that we love you the least, but we desire you the most. And if you want a more serious relationship with this podcast, you can have one by hitting the subscribe button at any time, as we discuss many other things apart from the UK. But today, we are discussing the UK. There's an imminent election, and the government's slogan in this election is Get Brexit Done, which the British have heard ad nauseum in the last month. Now, getting Brexit done on the current timetable means leaving the European Union on the 31st of January and then staying in the transition period inside the customs union until the end of 2020. If we don't agree a new trade deal by then, we will be, we the British, because I am British, we will be leaving the European Union with basically no deal. And the circumstances of whatever trade deal that will be will also affect the other trade deals we are seeking with Japan, Australia, United States, and basically the rest of the world. But I guess the first question, Maria, is can you do a trade deal in 1 year?
Okay, so a number of different questions here. First of all, to say that, yes, the possibility of a no-deal Brexit is still very much alive. It's not that we have gone over that tremble. So there is still... We need to sign the deal first, and then we can think about the trade deal in the future, so the long-term relationship. Your question as to whether you can do a proper trade deal in effectively less than a year is, of course, a very important question. It doesn't have a simple answer, but let me give you sort of bricks to build an answer with. The average time that a trade deal gets done, if you look at this, so all the bilateral trade deals that have been done across the world, bilateral, between any two sets of countries, the average time would be more than 2 years, right? So if you ask the question, can you do a deal within a year, then you're asking whether you can do a trade deal way below the average time length of any random trade deal. However, there is a very big variation in time length that these trade deals take. They can vary anything from 3 months all the way to basically open-ended, because there are trade deals that still haven't been signed or negotiations, so they're gone forever. Could the EU and the UK strike a deal, either at the average time or even shorter time, to meet the requirements you just described? There are a number of factors that could go both ways, in my view. You know, first of all, we haven't gotten there where we started talking about the trade deal. So that is an important obstacle that needs to be overcome before we can even start counting down. So that doesn't help. And the other thing is that it took us a very long time to come here to think that we can do the next step, which, by the way, is also the most important step, because it defines a long-term relationship, in such short time may be a little bit too ambitious. However, I will say this. Typically, the types of things that delay trade deals is uncertainty, so not knowing who your partner is, what types of things they want. That issue doesn't really hold for the partners we're talking about, the EU and the UK. We know each other very well. We know what we would be aiming for. It's not difficult to guess that. So in that respect, I think, if you get your minds to it, I think you can do a deal pretty quickly. The question is, would you put your mind to it, or are other issues would come in the way?
No, Nicholas, if Boris Johnson was here, he would be saying, this is going to be easy because we have regulatory alignment, so we're starting from a position of synchronization almost, so it should be the easiest trade deal in history.
Yeah, I don't think so. So if you look at the Brexit, the whole debate we had until this point, it was basically about the withdrawal period, so about the transition period. And everything that goes beyond now is actually the future. We're talking about the future, about a very, very long trade period, and actually also about what's going to be our future relationship. So if it was so difficult for the UK until this point to agree on anything about for a period of a transition period of 1 or 2 years, how difficult will it be politically, just even if we have a technical agreement in a year, how difficult will it be to pass this in the Commons? And in the end, these deals are not really about tariffs anymore. It's about regulation. And the whole way Brexit was solved was to say, we want to have our own, we want to be autonomous. We want to have sovereignty over our regulation. And to tell now the British voters that actually, yeah, we talked about this, but now we actually have to sign up to the regulation that the US, and which probably will end up in this deal, might politically be very difficult.
I actually agree with that. I think the regulatory issue is really the big issue to watch. I mean, the whole Brexit thing, as Nicolas said, was sold very much on this ability. We're going to decide what our regulation is going to be. And actually, the only way that Johnson managed to get agreement on anything is because he crossed all the red lines that previously were not going to be crossed. So, you know, you have to wonder how well will this be accepted in the British public, particularly the Brexiteers who are, you know, they really want that autonomy to come back. And the fight, I agree with Nicholas here, or maybe the war, will be fought on exactly how much of the regulatory alignment would the UK accept and yet leave the EU, right? Because if you leave the EU and just complete the regulatory alignment, then, you know, you might be asking why you're doing this in the first place. So that's the one to watch, and particularly for the financial sector.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because there may be a case where you, quote unquote, get Brexit done at the end of January. There's a ceremony, a flag comes down in Brussels, perhaps, and then perhaps the public attention goes off the whole process, and then the British can very quietly just reintroduce themselves to all the European things they were trying to get away from, and we have a very civilized, invisible Brexit taking us through to 2020. But I think the interesting thing is that they won't be able to acknowledge that publicly, and because they won't, it's going to be very hard for future trading partners like the United States, Japan, Australia, many other countries to form new trade deals with the United Kingdom, because they're not going to know exactly where we are, and we won't be able to publicly acknowledge that we're going to stay very close to European rules and regulations.
I don't think you can hide these things. I mean, you know, at the time when it happens, everybody will know exactly the terms on which these things happen. And, you know, this is the difficult part, because if, as you say, the UK conforms on everything that the EU asks, the Brexiteers are going to have a problem with this. I mean, they have loud voices and they have been vociferous in the past. So I just don't, this is what makes it difficult, in fact, right? So I think that part is the easy part. The difficult part is getting everybody to buy in whatever deal that is, whatever that first obstacle is. Depending on what you think about that, the rest would follow. If the UK has full regulatory alignment and managed to bypass the Brexiteers and get it through, then it would be easy to do trade deals with the rest of the world, because then everybody knows everything about everybody. But if that's not the case, and the UK pedals back and the EU accepts that, then of course then the negotiations between the UK and the rest of the world will be done on different terms than currently, which is basically the EU terms currently, as the UK is a member of the EU. All of this remains a big uncertainty in my view, and one shouldn't jump the gun in here, because I think there are a lot of uncertainties before we can even begin to think about the future deal.
So Nicholas, we've read and heard a lot about UK's potential red lines and these negotiations coming up, if they do happen. What would a good deal look like from a European Union perspective? What kind of red lines might Brussels have, for instance?
So I think Boris Johnson did kind of a magic trick in the past. There was a lot of red lines we had when he stepped into office. The reason that May was actually ousted out of office was a lot of these red lines. And suddenly in October, all these red lines were kind of not there anymore. And we got basically the same deal we had before. So I think it's kind of questionable where the red lines really are. And I think it's basically a question of internal UK politics. On the EU side, it was much clearer. And I think it's very clear what the EU wants. And I think the EU is also very aware of its negotiation power. And this power will even be stronger in the moment UK actually has left, technically, the European Union. So I think that this kind of the red lines still going to be there. And it's still going to be the same issues we're fighting about. I think the big issue here, or the big red line for the European Union, or the thing that UK might want to ask that you will not be willing to give, is first of all freedom to what is called to deviate what is called the level playing field, so kind of deviate from regulation on social, environmental, or health issues. And the second thing is financial services. So one of the biggest things, or one of the biggest sectors with UK is providing is the City of London, the financial services in London. And it seems to me very clear that the European Union wants to don't want to give up control over the European financial infrastructure by allowing the UK, a country being outside the European Union, to be a big financial center, or be basically having what's called passporting rights, so having the rights for banks, or financial institutions based in London to do EU business. So I think this is going to be the two big red lines for Europe that's going to be in debate.
And what kind of status do you expect the City of London to be able to maintain?
I think undoubtedly it will be remain one of the biggest financial centers in the world. I think that that's clear. I mean, there's other countries that are not aligned with big blocks. I mean, there's always this talk about Singapore and the Thames. There's other big financial centers that are not part of a big economy. So I think it's remained to be seen. But it's clear to me that some business move away will move away. And this is not something that you will give the UK.
Mm. And so, Maria, taken as one economy, the EU27 is by far Britain's largest trading partner. Second on that list is the United States. And as we've seen in the last year, and especially it's intensified in the last few months, is the United States has become known as a particularly antagonistic and difficult trading partner, and quite erratic as well. So I guess what I'm asking is the United Kingdom going to be able to negotiate with the United States and the EU simultaneously in a constructive way, or will it have to be in a kind of weird WTO grey zone while it's talking to the EU and then start with the United States?
Formally speaking, the UK can only engage in negotiations with third countries, with other countries, as it were, once the it has really formally exited the EU. It cannot.
So in February?
Well, I mean, remains to be seen whether it is in February, right? I mean, that's not.
If Britain leaves the European Union but stays in the customs union until December, can the United Kingdom talk to the United States between February and December?
Yes, I think it can. But I mean, the terms in which, that's the start of the negotiations. And remember, they will take some time to sort of understand the real basis of which negotiations happen. But the real problem thing here, first of all, the WTO is in itself shaky. And Nicholas has just written a blog, a very interesting blog on this, in which he explains exactly that. There is a weakening of the system, right, Nicholas? Yes, I mean, yes. I think that's an important thing. So the multilateral system as a platform on which to do trade, in any case, is weakened because of the reasons that Nicholas says in his blog. But the fact of the matter is you're having a smaller country negotiating with a bigger country. And the terms of these negotiations will be defined by power. That's inevitable. This is what happens in this negotiation. So to think that the UK can easily sail through and negotiations with the US is not going, particularly a US that is very antagonistic, as you described, Nicholas, then I think is probably an illusion. This is, I think, a big lose for the UK, I mean, because previously the UK was negotiating within the EU, where you have a bigger partner to play with. And you know, it remains to be seen how well it will do as a result. And remember, it has to negotiate trade deals, not with the US, but with all the countries that the EU has formally treaties, trade deals. That's administratively speaking, that's a big task.
For any confused listeners, there are two Nicholases at the table today.
Indeed.
Yes. So knowing what we do know about Donald Trump and what we've observed in the last few years, well, what kind of things would he want from a trade deal with the United Kingdom? What would be his demands? What would be on the table in that?
Well, you have to go sector by sector, but I think the access to his markets, he wants people to buy American products, he wants small tariffs on products and access to other markets. So, you know, basically the cake and eat it. I mean, that's a very very clear strategy. It's not executed very well in the current administration, because most people would agree that if you impose tariffs to third countries, given that the economy in the world is so integrated, you're effectively imposing tariffs of your own goods. And this is what we've seen. I think the manufacturing sector in the US is really suffering as a result of Trump imposing tariffs in third countries, primarily China. So, you know, you have to differentiate between what the policy is aiming to do and what it actually achieves, and the two are not necessarily aligned.
If I may add to this, the biggest export of the UK to US is cars. And I think a big good reference to look what a future relationship might look like is actually looking at the US-Japan agreement that was recently struck. And in this agreement, basically, US has pushed Japan to open up its agriculture market. And what Japan wanted back in the negotiations was an opening of the automotive sector. So the opening of the automotive market of the US. And they didn't got that because US didn't want that. And I think there should be a lot of caution in the UK what actually can be achieved. Another thing that what this car example, I think, very nicely highlights is the problem of rules of origin. So each trade agreement has what's called rules of origin. It's basically a share of the value added in a good that has to come from that country. So you don't want UK selling German cars to US under no tariffs, basically just putting a sticker on it. The European market is very integrated. So it will be a problem for UK in this value-added example, to actually, you have to show it through paperwork, but also to prove that the goods that they will export to US will actually be UK goods. And they are very integrated in the European market right now. A lot of the parts of this car comes to the European market, and this will create a lot of paperwork and regulatory hurdles.
So is that what you're saying, that for the UK, it's going to be quite difficult to independently strike a deal with the US, given how well integrated it is in the end? That's, of course, a very important point, and raises again the questions why the UK is doing this.
Now, I don't want to sound overly suspicious or anything, but is America a reliable negotiator at the moment? Is anything that can be agreed with America during this particular administration something that can be relied upon?
That's a difficult question, right? And also, I think we need to separate a little bit current administrations with American strategy, because I think they're not necessarily the same thing. It is clear that the U.S. has got issues when it comes to the global multilateral system. It has a strategy. It's not entirely obvious to all of us. It has certain strategic aims. On the other hand, it has certain tactics that perhaps are not very, very well understood. I think that the issue here is that the UK is a relatively small country for the US. So, if you think about the US trying to prioritize who they talk to, I would imagine China really is the partner they want to talk to right now. They want to see how far they can get in the current negotiations with China. And it's interesting to see that as we approach elections, China is also delaying certain things because, that they are playing also tactic games. I think that the timing for the UK is not good. Now, you could ever ask, would it ever be good, the timing? But I think now it's particularly bad because of the US probably would not be engaging actively with the UK to the extent it could.
Well, you suggested that Washington might push London around a bit just because of the size differential between the United States and the United Kingdom. But, I do think that there's a kind of ideological objection in the White House at the moment towards the European Union. And there could almost be a kind of chauvinistic attitude of being nice to the United Kingdom despite Brussels. So there could be that.
Yeah, but when it comes to the economics, it remains to be seen. They need to sort of sign papers that the US needs to see is beneficial for the US. So there is posturing and there is economic arguments, and it remains to be seen. But you're right, it could be a tactic that the current administration, one could see the current administration pursuing. But it remains to be seen. I don't think the UK would be a big priority for the US.
What kind of signs of bullying and being pushed around should we be looking out for?
Well, I think Nicholas's example of Japan is kind of I don't want to call it bullying, but you really do see that they're trying to, the rents that the US is trying to extract here is maximum, right? And, your ability to achieve that depends on your, global power. And the US for the moment remains. I don't know if you agree, Nicholas.
Oh, totally. And I think the same problem the UK will encounter to a lesser extent with the European Union. So if you're an international trade negotiation, size matters. It's important how big your market is, how important you are for the other ones. And UK is not super important for the US. And I think to sum up this example is, the US might say they won't be nice to UK, but every single thing they give to the UK, there will be a lobby in the US that says, we don't want you to give this access we want to produce this ourselves. So to sell politically, we give some gifts to UK. I think I find it very unrealistic.
And just before we finish, we're gonna have a kind of strange situation, it seems, where Northern Ireland is going to stay in the customs union, and then whatever happens to Britain after Brexit, whether life is going to be materially different for British people, we're going to have this kind of awkward relationship between Northern Ireland and Britain that I think is kind of unprecedented. I don't know if there are any precedents for that. How is that going to look? Is that going to be weird? Like, are you going to be able to negotiate a trade deal just for England, Wales and Scotland? What will happen to Northern Ireland?
This is a very important question. How this plays out. It is a very artificial arrangement. It had been previously a red line for good reasons, actually. You try not to break the UK. So you really, if you were to go down this line, you are jeopardizing the unity of the United Kingdom. How this in reality plays out is an important question. Not easy to forecast. I hope the union stays peaceful. I think that's the most important one. And economically, I think a lot can be done. But more importantly, the awkwardness, to the extent that exists, will be mostly on the political side than the economic one.
Mm. Well, we're coming up to a hard deadline for this podcast. So thank you, Maria. Thank you, Nicholas. And listeners, you can have your cake and eat it too, because you can keep a close relationship with us and dip in anytime you want just by hitting that subscribe button, and you'll be notified every time we release a podcast. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.